We're here to receive a report from the South African Human Rights Commission on the annual report to Parliament on PIA. I understand that there's a slideshow presentation that you want to make, but it's not working. Yes, but that means only the three of us can see it, Debbie. Well, you'll have to sit on the floor, JJ, and you may block our view. Well, can you help us, Munani?
We've got copies of the presentation.
Welcome, Dean. See, we had received the report and we've read it. So, is there anything new in the slide presentation, Chairperson Mashona, that we are going to hear other than what we've seen in the report?
Mainly what could be in the slide is a response to the questions that the committee raised previously.
Oh, I see.
There are questions, concerns that were raised. So basically we are responding to that question and making some few additions.
Right. Can honourable members, can we hear that without? I know that you are somewhat disempowered because you don't have the. Yeah. We'll switch it on. All right. Let's see how we can limp along.
Well, thank you, Chair. Honorable members of this committee, it's once again a pleasure for us as the Human Rights Commission to appear before you and mainly to respond to questions that you previously raised regarding PIA. This is a department that belongs to the Deputy Chairperson, and if you don't know already, we have tried to divide ourselves according to focus areas so that each commissioner concentrates in a particular area. So the PIA area is within the focus area of the Deputy Chairperson, and she and her team will be leading in this discussion. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thank you to the committee for inviting the commission to present today. I think that the ideal would have been, as has been recommended many times, to have a special Human Rights Commissioner dedicated to PIA. As it has stood for the last while, it has been one of several portfolios that fall under my purview. Our key person, our manager in the commission in PIA, has been newly appointed. And so I'd like to introduce Paula Adeleke, who will actually take you through the slide presentation that you don't have in front of you. I suppose I just wanted to... There's a lot of poaching going on. My research associate was poached by the city. So, Paula Adeleke, A-D-E-L-E-K. And I just wanted to just make a few introductory comments in relation to before I hand over to Paula. This was the issue of the particular discussion taking place right now at the time when we're looking at the Parliament is looking at the Protection of State Information Bill and the influence, the effect that poor people have in relation to the independent regulator around access to information. So focusing on PAIA from the Human Rights Commission with this committee is a welcome opportunity. You know, the constitutional right to access to information and PAIA was located in a clear political will and commitment to creating an open, responsive, transparent state from an apartheid state that had been characterized by state secrecy and it had been accompanied by massive human rights violations. So I think that at this particular point, the sharing the experience and some of the insights that the Commission has had in working with PAIA, I think is a useful opportunity for both ourselves and I'm sure with the committee as well. The issue of while we have the Constitution, while we have the legislation, what are our hearings, for example, on the right to water and sanitation, which we've held in 8 provinces to date, are showing is that the translation between the Constitution, legislation, and people's lived reality is still a long, long way to go. And the shift also to transparent, open, and responsive public service is not where we have reached yet. And it's demonstrated not just by the response or the lack of response of government departments to our ESA reports, but also in terms of the PAIA reports that have shown high non-compliance levels, especially at local government level, and which the committee has reported to this, which the commission has reported to this committee on several occasions, and the committee has committed itself to putting a plan on the table to address the non-compliance. And we look forward to hearing about that plan today and engaging with the committee about its plan. As you will hear from Fuller's detailed report, the Commission has directed its resources over the last year to strategically target senior leadership in public bodies, to train government information officers, and I think that one of the problems that you hear around the information officers is that they're often at a low level, they often don't have the resources to be able to effect their mandate. So we've done training programs and we've trained, I think, 1,605. The IOs were trained. And the impact of that is, you know, we can see it when we look at particular institutions. So for example, SASA, the South African Social Service Agency, whilst one individual was engaged with them, they in turn trained others in SASA from the Gulf Gauteng province. And they've got a program on that right now. The briefings to the heads of public bodies and the executive management in departments such as Labour, Communications, the Industrial Development Corporation and National Research Foundation have are institutions which had not been performing particularly well in relation to PAIA implementation, but after the Commission briefing they have put in place mechanisms and secure compliance and implement PAIA. And Paula will talk more to that. The Commission also undertaking compliance audits with 13 institutions in the last financial year to test the veracity of the Section 32 reports and the Section 14 manuals. And what the compliance audits have shown is that 90% of institutions are not compliant. There's an absence of systems to track and record results for requests for information. And I think a key problem is the resources to monitor request for information. I think that does link again to the question of political will and commitment. The compliance in terms of Section 14, the 25 of 44 national departments applied, and there's been a slight increase in the last year from 62% to 69.77% compliance at a national level in terms of national departments. At the provincial level, 55 out of 108 provincial departments, which represents an 11% increase. Well, I think you can confirm if I'm getting this correct. And in terms of municipalities, 33 complied and 246 were non-compliant. In terms of provincial compliance, what we've seen is where Commission has held the provincial information officers forum, there has been a correlating compliance rate has been extremely good. So, for example, the Free State and the Western Cape both had 100% compliance. Northern Cape, after the Provincial Information Officers Forum, has, after 3 years of non-compliance, after the PIOs, four of their departments have submitted Section 32 reports. The Commission's made several recommendations in terms of expanding Section 32 reporting obligations to include substantive reporting linked to, for example, British economic rights. Also, and we'll talk much more into the detail of a lot of these recommendations, a duty on the heads of public bodies to include Section 32 reports in their reports to Parliament and to penalise non-compliance and inaccurate reporting. In terms of reforming PAYA itself, the Commission has made a number of recommendations to the Department of Justice, and Fuller will detail the provisions, some of those provisions that the Commission has identified that need reform, but the feedback is still pending on that. The Commission also put forward to the Department of Justice its concerns around the Protection of State Information Bill, as well as the issue around the Protection of Personal Information Bill. These concerns encapsulated in the Commission's reports to Parliament about how far we have yet to go to create a transparent, open, responsive state that can ensure that our poorer citizens access the information that's relevant and essential to implementation of their human rights, particularly their socioeconomic rights. So I'm going to stop there and hand over to Fuller to take us through the overheads. Do you have it in hard copy in front of you?
No,
hard copy.
We have our report.
Okay, that's fine. Great. Thanks very much, and over to you, Fuller. Thank you.
Good morning, Deputy Chair. Good morning, Chairperson, and thank you to the committee for having us to table the PAYA report. This is the first time that the Commission is tabling the PAYA report as a separate report, which is not part of the Commission's annual report, and we'll welcome the opportunity that Parliament has given us and the priority that Parliament has accorded to PAYA monitoring and promotion in the public service. We are confident that such support will encourage increased compliance in the public service. We table the PAYA annual report acknowledging the impending passage of the Protection of Personal Information Bill, which strips the Commission of its powers in terms of PAYA. And we hope that in this session we'll be able to clarify the role of the Commission moving forward in terms of our own obligations with regard to the right of access to information. For, as Deputy Chair has already stated, for the reporting period 2011-2012, a lot of our resources were directed on training. In the 12 years of the existence of the passage of PAYA, there have been 10 major studies, both by the Commission and other NGOs. And in those 10 studies, the one thing that is consistent in findings has been the lack of compliance on PAYA by public institutions. Also, there has been a lack of appreciation by the public service on the importance of the right of access to information in the work they do. And this problem is particularly evident in local governments where they don't appreciate the importance of access to information for meeting service delivery needs, and how that an access to information, public participation and voluntary disclosure of information can serve as a tool in stabilizing a lot of the community protests that we see about service delivery needs. And the objectives of PAYA are quite clear, about fostering a culture of transparency and accountability in society to have effective access to information for people to be able to exercise and protect their other rights. And in recognition of these lofty objectives by PAIA, the Commission has set up its own specialist unit to monitor PAIA compliance by both public and private institutions. And this unit is responsible for promoting and monitoring compliance with protecting the right of access to information firstly, and also directed at promoting the flow of information and good governance in public and private institutions. We've identified five core mandates in terms of our constitutional and statutory obligations. And the first one deals with the promoting the right of access to information through the development of educational programs. The second one is assisting public and private bodies to comply and implement PAIA. And in this instance, we take on the role of a consultancy service where we assist public and private institutions to comply with their PAIA obligations. We offer legal advice to them on how to respond to some of the difficult requests they receive, and also offer training. And in terms of our community interventions, we also go out to the communities highlighting the linkage between the usage of PAIA in accessing information that might meet other service delivery needs that people want. And then we also monitor legislative development and contribute to law reform. And in our training, as stated by the deputy chair already, one of our biggest achievements is the fact that we trained over 1,000 deputy information officers. We conducted 33 workshops, and what we've been doing in the last reporting period has been introducing the components of the Protection of Personal Information Bill into our training. As the deputy chair mentioned, an example is the South African Social Service Agency, who had not been complying with PAIA, and then they requested training from us, and then we realized that there had been several instances where there have been complaints against social workers by people receiving grants about the fact that their personal information was not being properly managed by these social workers. So embedded in our training in the last year has been introducing principles of the Protection of Personal Information Bill before it's been passed to make these new PAIA officers aware of the complementarity of both PAIA and the bill. And as stated by the deputy chair as well, we've realized that in taking the training sessions a bit further, we need to engage the executive personnel of public departments. So we've engaged in what in things that are called management briefings, where we bring in the senior leadership of public institutions to attend meetings, and in that sense, the heads of these public institutions ensure that all the business units of the respective public bodies are trained and guaranteed awareness of PAIA monitoring and compliance within their respective institutions. And we also conduct compliance audits. And in terms of our compliance audits, we have attached annexed a consolidated audit report for the last 5 years to our annual report. Because of resource constraints, we've only been able to audit 43 public institutions in the last 5 years. In the last reporting period, we audited 13 public institutions. And in our audit report, we highlight a number of findings, and we make a number of recommendations. Recommendations for the Commission itself on how we take our own work forward, recommendations for individual public institutions, as well as recommendations on specific focus areas, for instance, records management practices. And the objectives of the audit are to provide insights for the Commission to develop effective interventions and internal systems aimed at supporting public institutions, to inform the Commission's monitoring of mandatory compliance, to inform the Commission's recommendations on how to improve PAIA, identify focus areas, best practices, and respond to the concerns of public officials. And in terms of our findings over the last 5 years, only 25% of public officials know who their deputy information officers are or about the procedures. 87% of frontline officials are not aware of prior procedures, and this is despite the fact that in the previous reporting period, 2009-2010, the Commission spent a lot of money developing a frontline manual, and this frontline manual was disseminated to all the public institutions, and special instructions were given to public institutions that had been trained on prior to use these frontline manuals to train their own internal staff on how to use prior procedures. 60% of institutions audited had not formally designated their deputy information officers. 20% of institutions had incorporated prior into the strategic planning processes. And only 15% of audited public institutions had a prior budget. And supporting the compliance audit that we conduct, we also have the Golden Key Research. The Golden Key Research has the same aim as the compliance audit, to monitor compliance by public institutions, but we adopt a different methodology. For the Golden Key Research, what we do is we send out prior requests for information for different documents, and those documents that we request for are split into four different categories. We ask for documents relating to statutory compliance, documents relating to records management, documents relating to internal mechanisms of the institution and how to comply with prior, and also documents relating to whether there have been any resources that have been allocated to prior implementation. And Golden Key Research culminate into the National Information Officers Forum that we conduct on a yearly basis. So while our emphasis is on training respective public institutions, what we do is we now bring all the deputy information officers in respective public departments together for Information Officers Forum. We have Provincial Information Officers Forum and National Information Officers Forum. And Chair, if you recall, at our last National Information Officers Forum, you were the guest speaker and you spoke about the complementarity of the Protection of Personal Information Bill and the Promotion of Access to Information. And the same was done by Honorable Jeffries in the last NRAF, where again the topic was on Protection of Personal Information Bill and how it complements the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And what we found in our NRAF trainings has been we provide capacity building tools to support implementation of the law, we create networking opportunities, we showcase best practices, and we provide insights on practical challenges. And as the Deputy Chair has already stated, the Provincial Commission of Staff Forum have been successful in that where we have conducted them, we've achieved 100% compliance in two of the provinces, the Western Cape and the Free State. And in other provinces where we've introduced them, their compliance would have improved. The primary purpose of the annual report, as stated in Section 83 and Section 84 of PIA, is that we must present to Parliament the compliance statistics by public institutions on their Section 32 reports. And from the Section 32 reports that we received, a total of 39,856 requests we have submitted to different public institutions. But that figure is by no means accurate, because public institutions do not accurately report in their Section 32 reports on prior requests that they have received. And of those almost 40,000 requests received, about 32,000 prior requests were granted. Now, this creates the impression that if 40,000 requests were made and 32 were granted, that perhaps public institutions are doing well. But that is actually an inaccurate reflection. The devil is in the detail. The institution that receives the most prior requests is the South African Police Services. And since 2009, they've been very compliant with prior. So while they receive over 20,000 requests on a yearly basis, they also grant a lot of those requests for information. And if you look at the detail of the Section 32 report, you'll find that a lot of institutions actually do not grant requests for information. And examples would be the Office of the Presidency, National Treasury, and the Department of State Security. Those three institutions hardly granted requests for information that were made to them. But the problem with the format of Section 32 report is we don't know the kind of information that were sought, and we do not know why those requests were denied. Hence, we've made substantive recommendations in our prior reports for an amendment of the Section 32 format, and we believe that such review of Section 32 should consider expansion of Section 32 reporting obligations to include substantive reporting, the disaggregation of the request type, extension of the Commission's powers to penalize both non-compliance and inaccurate reporting, as well as a detailed list of public bodies to provide Section 32 reports to Parliament over and above the one they submit to the Commission. We also feel that public bodies should bear the cost by the Commission in instances where we choose to audit the veracity of the Section 32 reports that have been submitted to us. And one thing that also become clear in the Section 32 reports that we receive is that despite training, public officials are not clear whether requests for different but related documents submitted on one form constitute a single request. They are not certain on how to capture requests that they received at the end of a reporting period, but they only dealt with it at the start of a new reporting period. And they are also not certain when discovery rules of court will apply in a matter being litigated and when prior can be used. We made a number of achievements in the last reporting period. Aside from the fact that we trained a record number of over 1,000 deputy information officers, I think our biggest achievement would be the fact that the Commission facilitated the development of a model law on freedom of information for Africa. And we developed this model law in partnership with the Center for Human Rights. We engaged various stakeholders on the continent, and we went to the different regions on the continent for buy into this model law. And at the last session of the African Commission on Human People's Rights, this model law was tentatively adopted pending the accurate application of the law into French. Despite our achievements, we also have a number of challenges. We appreciate the fact that when the Commission presented the annual report last month in October, approval was given for Bayer to get more money. But what has happened with our budgetary constraints has been the fact that it has affected our community trainings and enforcing compliance by public institutions. We have not been able to train as many communities as we would like to, so we've had to prioritize our advocacy interventions, and we've also had to prioritize our complaints that we deal with. So as a result of this prioritization exercise, there's been that unfortunate public perception of inefficiency. There's also been the problem of sustaining the political will of senior leadership that we've engaged with on prior compliance by government institutions. And most significantly, we've had the challenge of the need for certain amendments of provisions in prior. And we made several recommendations to the Department of Justice, and we haven't received a response yet. And some of these recommendations for the amendment of prior include a statement of clarity on Section 51. Section 51 deals with compliance by small business enterprises on the submission of manuals relating to prior. Now, the Commission had to hire 5 data capturers to deal with the monitoring of Section 51 manuals after the Minister of Justice failed to extend on time exemptions granted to private bodies from complying with the submission of Section 51 manuals. So because of the failure to extend this exemption of time, the Commission has received over 1 million manuals as of today. And we simply lack the IT and human resources to capture, review and process these manuals. And these contracts of these data capturers are going to expire at the end of this month. And once that happens, the Commission can no longer carry on its work on Section 51 manuals. And we need guidance on how to comply with our mandates with respect to that. Also, as stated before, we've made recommendations on changing the format of reporting under Section 32. We made recommendations on Section 46 of prior, to be amended to be less stringent on how to access information to be disclosed in the public interest. We also made recommendations on Section 90 for the Commission to have powers to penalize non-compliance on Section 32 reporting. We made recommendations on Section 42, where we recommend that information of financial institutions should be protected. and also made recommendations to the Department of Justice to engage with the South African Judicial Education Institute to train magistrates who have been designated to hear parameters. Since the passage of the rules of courts that allows magistrate courts to hear prior matters, there's been no single prior application to a magistrate court simply because magistrates have not been trained on prior. The precondition for magistrate courts to be able to hear prior matters is for them to be trained, but that has not been done since then. And we present these challenges acknowledging the fact that all prior powers of the Commission will soon be assigned to the Public Information Regulator in terms of the Protection of Personal Information Bill. However, despite the fact that these powers have been assigned to the Public Regulator, the Commission will nevertheless retain its residual powers in terms of the constitutional mandate of the Commission to monitor the right of access to information. So as a result of these dual mandates to both bodies, we believe that there is a need for the development of a comprehensive handover from Commission to the regulator. And this will include issues such as notification in terms of PIA and the proposed Protection of Personal Information Bill, the mandate of the regulator in monitoring statutory compliance, handover of the Commission's complaints files of PIA, as well as a heavy public advertisement on the transfer of the PIA mandate to the regulator. Because the modest success is achieved in ensuring compliance by public institutions has mostly been done by engaging the media, using them in reaching out to public institutions about the need for them to submit their Section 32 reports and their Section 14 manuals to the Commission. The Commission will continue to fulfill its constitutional mandate in terms of the right of access to information, even though our powers are assigned. By mainstreaming substantive compliance on prior in complaints and advocacy interventions by the provincial offices and the research program of the Commission. The findings that have been made in the Commission's work on prior and in our annual reports have given us to identify weak areas in three areas. In PIA itself, in usage of PIA, and in implementation and compliance with PIA. And these identified areas help the Commission in fulfilling our promotion, protection, and monitoring mandates in respect of PIA and to assess the impact of our work. Increase in financial resources will no doubt go a long way in enabling us to conduct more community outreach workshops, roundtable meetings, and participating in strategic litigation to improve both the procedural and substantive components of PIA. And given the importance of PIA in the pursuit of transparency and accountability ideals in our new democracy, we reiterate our commitment to advancing access to information in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ehrlich. And Deputy Chair, Press Governor, Mr. Jeffrey.
Thanks. And thanks very much to the Commission for coming. I think it's important, I mean, I think it's the first time we've actually engaged with the PIA report. And, you know, it's a very comprehensive document. With a lot of information that I think is very useful. But maybe just to, I mean, the purpose of the engagement is your reporting to us and us seeing where we can assist. So I think all the comments I'm going to make, some of them may be a little bit harsh, they're made in a constructive context. I think the first issue, though, is just something that the Deputy Chair raised, which is you're waiting to hear our plan of action. I think there was a misunderstanding, and I have heard, Chair, that there was, I think, a letter from the CEO to the House Chair which reflected the Human Rights Commission waiting for the Justice Committee to report to it on what they were going to do. And I think that's a misunderstanding. I mean, you report to us, and we can then see where we assist. So I'm going to have suggestions to the committee on how we take this matter further, but it's that's the level of reporting as far as I understand it. That's the one point. Then just one issue, I think a major frustration on the PAIA report, and it's something I did raise in the annual report process, that you just, I think I used the analogy of it sort of a bit like an ostrich with its head in the sand. You don't like the protection of personal information, and you've sort of, it's just not there. So if you look at your report, you deal quite extensively with the Protection of State Information Bill, and then you talk about amendments that you want to PAIA. No mention in your report of personal information, no substantial information about or reaction to it. And, you know, the amendments you want to PAIA, many of them have been done. Okay. We did amend, or we did seek to amend PAIA when we dealt with the protection of personal information. We did request on a number of occasions to the Human Rights Commission, please tell us what amendments you would suggest to make it easier to operate. And we basically didn't get anything. We had to rely on ODAC as an NGO, which is not really, you know, one would expect the Human Rights Commission. So, for example, Section 51 is amended. There is no longer a requirement when that comes into effect for everybody to be submitting these manuals. There's no amendments to Section 32, but there's a lot of fairly substantial amendments. What is worrying, I mean, is that it doesn't seem as though you've looked at it. You know, even to ask us what's going to happen to the Human Rights Commission when the regulator take over, I mean, it's in the bill. It's in the transitionary provisions, you know, and it's specifically, 1144, the South African Human Rights Commission must in consultation with the information regulator finalize or conclude its functions referred to in sections 83 and 84 of PAIA as soon as reasonably possible. And there's a section on transitional provisions. I'm not sure how much more detail can be given. Obviously, the act, I think, it was actually chair scheduled to be past the day in the NCOP, but I think they want more time, so it would be early next year. But it's going to take, you know, the regulator has to be set up. It's still going to be a while, and then there would be basically a movement of those enforcement functions. The promotion functions, I think, largely would continue with the Human Rights Commission. But there's no amendment, by the way, to Section 32, because nobody actually raised that with us. I mean, I don't know why you were, when we were amending PAIA, why you didn't speak to us about it. These amendments came from the committee, not from the department. And as I said, they were largely from NGOs like ODAC. And I mean, it happened, it's done, but I don't know why it happened. And I would hope it doesn't happen again. Anyway, that's a sort of just a general point. Also on the issue of the magistrates' courts, it's something that the committee has been engaging with the department regularly on. I'm interested that you raise it now because I don't find any reference to it in your report. But I think it is an important issue to pursue, and we should both be pursuing it. That, you know, the section... sorry? No, that's because you came in at the last minute and watched a quick fix. After we passed the Protection of Personal Information Bill. Anyway, I agree with you on that one. I think the issues for me, Chair, is I think everything is sort of set out very clearly. I think it would have been useful, so these are not my questions, those were comments meant to be constructive. My questions were just on compliance monitoring audit. It would be useful to have had more detail in the report. It's a general overview. We're quite keen, I think, on honing into where the problems are. And it would have been useful to have had that. I think one also just needs to make the point that you can play on page 29 of your report about LASA, Legal Aid South Africa. They were not, when we put that to them, because they came after in the annual reports, they were not very happy with the report. They disputed it. So just to sort of raise that with you. Then I think, Chair, that non-compliance of the national departments with Section 14 and Section 32, you have given us with Section 32 on page 36 a list of the non-compliant national departments.
Page
36 of this report, the big report. So those are the ones that are not reporting. Chair, I think, I'm not sure why you've got this summer in sort of light brown and others are in dark brown. I'm not sure if that's actually colour. I'm not sure if that means anything or whether that is just for ease of reading. But Chair, I think what we should do is in our report list them and want to know from the relevant ministers within a particular period of time. I mean, this report we won't do now because it will lapse. It should get tabled early in the new year. We should want to know from the relevant ministers what they're doing to ensure that they are compliant, why they couldn't comply and what they're doing. I know there's a whole lot more with Section 32, and you've raised the issue of the detail needed is often not helpful, but at least I think let's start with the non-compliance. And then Section 14 is a little bit more difficult. That's the manual and web page. You've got to sort of sift out who's wrong, who's at fault, who isn't. But I suppose we could do that, although I think that a similar reporting format, listing departments, would be better. You sort of list some but not others, whereas there seems to be sort of more that are problematic. But I think we should do a similar thing with that, Chair, of listing them and wanting them to report to the National Assembly as to what had happened. Chair, I think that's sort of largely it. Oh yeah, just the figure of was it, were you saying 25% of public officials don't know about PAYA? And where did you get that from? Did I hear it correctly, and on what basis? Is that an estimate? If I can just get detail on that. Actually, I've got a few more questions, but let me just stop there. I've spoken for long enough, as I'm sure the Chair will agree.
Only 25% of public officials know who their deputy information officers are, okay, or about IEF procedures, which means 75% don't.
Is that an estimate?
Well,
I mean, I presume it's not empirical.
That is a finding from our compliance audit. So we are talking about the 43 public institutions audited.
Okay. I have Ms. Schaefer, Ms. Swart. Ms. Smart, did I see your name? Your hand? Yes. Okay. Ms. Schaefer.
Thank you very much. I will be much briefer. I just want to know, would you support a removal of the requirement magistrates to be trained from the Act? I mean, do you think it would have any negative consequences? Because that was what my view, that we should actually not have that legislation, that magistrates who are appointed should be able to apply the law when it's made. Secondly, have you had any engagement with the public protector regarding...
Could you just repeat that question?
The first one?
Yeah.
Would you support the proposition of removing from the legislation the requirement for magistrates to be trained before they can implement PAYA? Secondly, have you had any engagement with the public protector regarding any complaints, prior complaints that she has received? I'm quite concerned about the Department of Justice not responding to you. Can you give us more detail as to what you've done to try and get them to respond, particularly on the manual issue? I mean, the day before the deadline, they extended it, it is ridiculous. It's created a huge amount of extra work for you, and some of us have also had queries from people wanting to know what's going on. Have you tried to sort out that issue with them, and if so, what have you done? And then finally, I'm just interested in your comments and your submissions, particularly regarding the, well, it may not be controversial, although I don't know why, but the state information law. What is your view, from what I've read in your document, it would appear that you still aren't satisfied with the current version that's been now approved by the NCOP. Is that in fact so? What aspects do you still regard as unconstitutional? And are you prepared to take any action if it goes through as it is? And if so, what?
Are you still going to get to the international reporting? Because I again see that there's... Is that the next item? Okay. Then just on fire, there was on Parliament. Does Parliament have to also report Section 32? And I understand in your last year's report, the Parliament did give a report, but there's no reference to that in this year's report. And so I'm not sure whether a report was submitted by Parliament or not. And the issue of the magistrates again relates to the whole issue of litigation, and it would make a lot of sense if one could remove that requirement of the training, because it seems that there's a major problem. From reading the report, there's still a huge amount of non-compliance, and yes, we do need to back you politically, as I've said continually, but also there's also minimum litigation that is taking place, mainly due to resource costs. And would that not assist you if we could find a way that magistrates could also sit in forcing non-compliance issues? And then just on the issue of the unit here in the Deputy Speaker's office, to what degree does that, have you been able to meet with them? Are they assisting you when it comes to, clearly they can't take away our responsibility as the Justice Committee. But again, it's an issue of to what degree are they able to assist you with this whole issue of non-compliance. When I read the report, I still see high levels of non-compliance, which is a great concern, and it is an issue which you do continually raise in your reports, but surely we should be taking a greater step from our side, and also using that unit and using litigation somehow. As far as litigation is concerned, is it possible to work with other bodies, understanding your financial constraints, such as the Legal Resources Centre or the Legal Aid South Africa, to bring some test cases or to get involved in such litigation? And then you do make reference on page 15 of the Protection of State Information Bill, the statement that raised the issues, but I just wanted to ask you, I see that you refer to the ad hoc committee, and one presumes that you are, that's the HLP ad hoc committee and the NA that was earlier this year. And I just endorse her questions as to whether you've studied the final version, being the custodian of PIA, and the impact that it would have, and with the understanding that it is now going to come back to the National Assembly, and we trust that you'd be hopefully making further submissions to that reconstituted ad hoc committee as to what your views are on the final version, and particularly on the trumping clauses, as well as the trumping clauses and the public interest defence. Thank you, Ben.
Okay, I want to ask a few questions which are aimed at dealing with the Protection of State Information Bill. You make reference in your report to record keeping, because you obviously cannot give people access to the information they seek if you aren't keeping your records properly. And you refer also to the fact that the National Archives Act, the National Archives and Record Keeping Act of South Africa, is the act under which rules are set for people to file plans for the record keeping. They have to they have to develop something called a file plan, right? Now, you say that implementation has often not begun because the plans were not approved. Now, I would like to know much, much more. And if you don't have the answers, I would like to suggest respectfully that you go find out, because this is interesting, it is difficult, and it goes to the heart of really the ultimate problem with the Protection of State Information. Well, the ultimate problem there is what the Human Rights Commission, in its very fine submission during the 2010 round, pointed out. It is the fact that the Minister of State Security sits like a very big spider with many tentacles at the heart of the system that the Protection of State Information tries to legislate. It's not even recreating it, because it already exists. It has existed since the Mandela cabinet. Namely, the State Security Agencies, the SPUPRI, are the people who are given the duty under the MIS, Minimum Information Security System, to tell people how to look after their records, to inspect them, to monitor them, and the like. The situation already exists. The Protection of State Information Bill tries to perpetuate it in two ways. It deals not just with classified information, it deals also with something it has cheerfully dubbed valuable information, and the role of the Act is to protect such information against alteration, destruction, or loss. And the minister in the Protection of State Information Bill, all this you know, but I'm repeating for the sake of refreshing our memories, is allowed to write regulations. He can prescribe how not just classified information, but also valuable information. Valuable information is just ordinary information, which you mustn't lose, you must file it, you must keep it in record. He can write the prescriptions. This is from the point of view of the Democratic Alliance, one of the major problems with the Act. Nobody else has been remotely interested because they got excited about classification. Of course, many people thought that it was a law about media, which it never was. It's a classification law, such as any democracy has. But ours goes beyond what classification laws do in other countries. It also wants to perpetuate the system under which our very fine intelligence services look after ordinary record keeping. So this is highly relevant. Now, you have found, you say quite rightly, that there is already a law that tells people how to do record keeping. This is something that we plaintively repeated to my friend Mr. Landers and others during committee proceedings in the Protection of State Information. There is already a law that is who must write the regulations for record keeping, and that person is the National Archivist. One certainly got the impression that this was a bird in the breach, because meantime, back on the ranch, the security services have also been doing the same task. And so the question arises, who's in charge? Is the National Archives and Record Keeping Act actually functional? And I would really like it if you can't answer that now, if you could go and investigate, because if the file plans are not being approved, therefore implemented, what is happening? Is it just a lacuna, or are the government departments in fact filing under instructions under the MIS? And you will get, I promise you, you'll get very interesting answers. I have asked a whole series of parliamentary questions about the instruments under which government departments classify, how much they've classified. There's a lot of information there, and a lot of them cite the MIS, a lot of them do cite the archives, but it would be quite interesting to know what really obtains, because this might be yet another reason why access to information is difficult in this country. So any comments you can give me now, but I would appreciate some research. The address on Section 46, it's news to me also, as to the Honourable Jeffrey, that you have long been petitioning the Justice Department for amendments to certain prior sections. If I've forgotten, forgive me, but I didn't know that you had. In particular, Section 46, which is the public interest override. And we couldn't agree with you more that it is too stringent. Why should an official or anybody else be under a duty to release as an override only when there's been a substantial transgression of the law, and not any transgression of the law? Only when there is an imminent public health and safety risk, not any kind of a health and safety risk. So we agree with you. Again, it could have been interesting to know before. I think I heard you say that. There was simply a response from justices. That's correct. Right, okay. So as things stand, we are at least in a position, and in fact we did in the National Assembly say the Protection of State Information replicates that public interest override in the Protection of State Information. Because given the constitutional status of the PIA, you can't not. So it's in there, and the only remaining dispute was to what degree we wanted further public interest defenses. So really two answers. Tell me more about record keeping. And on Section 46, do I hear you correctly, you simply never got a response from Justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think on the last question around Section 46, the Public Interest Clause, and of course the archives, those are things that maybe we need to give a much more deeper response, and I think we take the challenge. I'm not so sure how much time will be given when the bill is now coming back to the National Assembly, whether there will be enough time, but I think...
Mr. Swart was, I think, wrong. I mean, there's no further public hearing, there's no public input. It's limited to acceptance or rejection of the amendment, of each amendment.
That's all? Yeah, that was our worry, but whatever it is, we will decide as a commission what position we are going to take, because there are certain areas where we feel strongly that take it or leave it, but then we need to make our point known, so that as it goes further, probably our point will be there. The other issue perhaps that you raised that I can respond to, but the rest will be responded by the Deputy Chair, relates to the unit in Parliament. I think we all know that the head of that unit has been out of work since February or January. She was sick, and she has just come back now, and since then the acting person also left, and to a certain extent that unit was dysfunctional, and we did not get a lot of help or support from that section, but we were assured that there is new staff. The director is now back in the office, and we hope we'll get much more assistance from that office. There is an attempt by all Chapter 9 and some of the Chapter 10 institutions. They are working out to meet with the speaker to try and relook at the functionality of this particular office. We met a week ago, so there was a strong feeling that maybe we need to revisit how we can relate or how we can work with this section, because there is not much interaction between us and the office of the speaker or the deputy speaker. So we are in the process of following up that particular one, because initially we thought that is one of the offices that can help us in terms of tracking some of the things that where there are blockages and the like, but also at the same time bearing in mind that we do not duplicate what we're doing with parliamentary committee, because sometimes there's a very thin line between who do you go to, but I think there's not much confusion about who does what. But I'll leave the rest to the Deputy Chair and Fola.
Thanks so much, Chair, and thanks to the members of the committee for the questions that you raised. I think the issue about the reporting to the Justice Committee on Jeffries, I think that absolutely we report to this committee with the intention of the committee that to identify areas where it can assist the Independent Human Rights Commission as a Chapter 9 institution to perform its mandate to as effectively as possible. And I think that the issue of the plan of action was something that was raised in the context of non-compliance by government departments and a request from the Commission to this committee that we submit our reports to this committee every year about the non-compliance and what does the committee do with our reports. That's the question that we raised, and the response from the Chair much earlier this year was that the committee would actually seriously look at how it could assist us, and it would develop a plan of action, and it would put that to us. And I think that's the context. I'm not sure, I don't think you were in the committee meeting that day when the Chair did actually respond to the Commission's concern about what happened to our reporting, because we report government departments are being non-compliant to this committee in the hope that there will be assistance by the committee to ensure that those departments are held to account, and whether it's national, provincial, or local in terms of the ANCOP.
Let's come in there. You know, I was there, and I've been raising the issue as well. I don't think it was an action plan.
The word may be correct, but I think it was about what would the Commission
I've made a proposal now, because that's as largely as much as we can do. It's basically we report it to the House, get the House to adopt adopt the report and the recommendation, the department's report to the House within a particular period of time, and that's effectively, but that's not an action plan. And then I think similarly, because provincial government departments don't fall under us as National Assembly, that I've made a suggestion that the Human Rights Commission go look doing a report to the NCOP, and then SABR are also present in the NCOP.
That's fine, and I think that you know, the term may have been incorrect, but I think the gist is the same. I think the gist is what actually gets done with it. So I think that absolutely the proposals you're putting forward today are very useful ones, and that we look forward to actually seeing then what's being done within the National Assembly in terms of ministers being held to account, lists of non-compliant departments, etc. And I know the Chair would like to come in on this as well.
Maybe just to come out clear, you know, as we leave particularly on this particular issue, I'm not sure whether we as a Commission have done everything that the Act says we must do, because we don't want to go a long way and say, look, you have got powers, have you called these people to your office, did you subpoena them to come and explain? So I just want to say, look, much as I really appreciate from your side, you know, the undertaking, I think we too need to try and move a step further, because we do have powers to call the responsible ministers and question them, and only then, when they are not responding, can we say, look, we've done everything that is within our act to do that. It's something that sometimes we are reluctant to do if we can find such information in a much more easier way. But I just wanted to make sure that while we welcome what you are saying, but we also say we still have a responsibility from our side to also do something much more than what we have done now. Thank you.
Chair, I think that there is agreement within the Commission and clarity about the fact that we have to use the subpoena powers, and I think we've begun to do that. So I think in terms of as an institution, we've begun to use the powers of the institution much more. So I think that in addition to, I suppose, what is done in Parliament in terms of its oversight responsibility, the issue of the transition from the Commission's powers in relation to to POPI's independent regulator, I suppose we'd actually appreciate clarity in relation.
We don't like that name. EPI.
No. Okay, we're having some problems with terminology today, Honourable Jeffrey, but I think it's the same thing we're referring to, I hope.
Maybe you can use the abbreviation PBI.
At this moment it's not OPIA, it's POPIP.
Poppy, doesn't sound that good, and poppy sounds like a flower.
Okay, we will get poetic after this meeting. But in the meantime, what we'd feel clarity on is the issue of the transitionary period, and I think it's particularly important in terms of budgeting and planning for the Commission. So no, the issue of the budgetary provisions within that, because I think that FOMO raised a very specific thing, for example, very practical specific thing. We have people hired right now as data capturers. Their term, their contract finishes at the end of this month. Due to the fault of the task has not been complete that they're hired for. The issue of the budget is a very big problem for the Commission. And it's always a big problem for the Commission. So I think that's the clarity that would be very useful from the committee. Because I think it really relates to how we work in this transitionary period, particularly in relation to the budget and the program of work of the Commission in this period. And I'm going to ask, I'm going to hand over to Fola to go through some of the more specific questions, and then the Chair and myself will come in on some of the overall issues. Thanks.
Before he does that,
Chair.
Just a couple of things. I had recognized Advocate Gachawayo, who has joined us and seated at the back there. We did report in our BRRR that we would discuss the matter raised by Mr. Jeffrey in our strategic planning session. Now, that's going to take place sometime in the new year, unfortunately for you. So that's a first response. The I understand Mr. Jeffrey's point, because when you read some of these documents, it reads like you are instructing us to present you with responses that you've requested. And so, you know, I know it may not be intention. It may just be that you are requesting clarity. Yes, we did give a certain undertaking. Let me address on one of the points you've raised in another document or letter to us. The international conventions, for example. My understanding, honourable members and Mr. Jeffrey, is that this is an executive function assigned by the executive. Parliament's role is to endorse that. And that's it. I don't know whether International Relations Portfolio Committee takes it further than they do. We would need to engage with them on that. But from time to time, you come to us and say, well, South African government signed this convention, and what it means is they have to take the following additional steps. And you say to us as a committee, now, take it further? Now, there are constraints even on us. It's just one example that I thought I should raise, Trex, to demonstrate to you why it's not as easy as you may think. Mr. Jeffrey?
And Mr. Swart's been wanting to raise the item as well, but I thought, you know, this is a document they've just given us on the international stuff, and there was an annexure in the, don't have it here.
It might be from Advocate Keshwaya's office.
Is this from Advocate Keshwaya? For yourselves?
Yeah.
It's called South African Human Rights Commission Annual International Report 2011. That's yours. Yeah, okay. All right. But, you know, because, Chair, I think the issue would be, if you look at the torture cat, the complaint generally one gets from the public or those interest groups is that we took so long to, we dealt the bill very fast, gone,
sure.
But it took a long time to get tabled. Mm-hmm. And I think the issue would be, what would be useful for us as well, looking at the international material, is to know which are the responsible departments.
And the annexure that the Human Rights Commission gave us in response to our questions, I think it's called Annexure E,
is interesting in that, you know, there's a number of treaties where the Department of Justice is the responsible body. And I think seeing we perform oversight over that department, it would be useful. I mean, in fact, in this document, you're familiar with it, I assume, it's basically us and, I mean, Department of Justice and Women and Children. I think with the justice ones, we should be then writing to the DG to say, give us a report as to, you know, identifying what are the issues that are outstanding, give us a report. And maybe then for you, Chair, to write to the Chair of the Women, Children and People with Disabilities Committee to say, the Human Rights Commission have told us that the Convention for the Rights of the Child, you say it's not particularly clear maybe it's in your other document, what the non-compliance is, but it would be useful to be able to say, Chair, Human Rights Commission have reported that on this convention, the Department of Women, Children and People with Disabilities has not done A, B, C, D, and E. Can you please establish from them what the problem is? And then for us with justice, if one looks at, say, this International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the responsible department is justice, and the previous report was in 2000, and the next report was due this year. not clear what else is. I haven't seen this document, we just got it now. Mm. And it's your annual report. Yeah. But it would be important to know where is the department, what haven't they done? And then we as the oversight committee, I think, Chair, you should write to them because they have it in advance and they can table a report. Say to them what is happening. I know the chair of the Human Rights Commission complained about the International Convention for ICESRC. Now that one I know, and he wrote to Parliament on it. And that one I know that Cabinet announced about a month ago that they had agreed to the ratification, so that would presumably be then coming to Parliament, but Chair, it's worthwhile. I understand Justice is the lead department. I mean, my understanding of the delay was the problem of finding a department that was willing to take responsibility and eventually went to Justice. And I think there were some other aspects, there were some possible legal problems, but it would appear as though those have been resolved. But you know, so that kind of thing, we know the issue is ratification, so it would be an issue writing to the DG to say, okay, Canada have approved it, when will the treaty be coming to Parliament for ratification? Other things would be other aspects. It would be issues of reporting, us not reporting in time. Others would be, if it was with the Convention Against Torture, it would be, we ratified this treaty, why is the legislation taking so long? Give us a report, Department, as to where it is, because that was the problem with CAC.
Thanks very much for that, Honourable Jeffries. I think that would go a long way in assisting progress on many of these conventions. I think that as the Commission we've engaged with ministers and we've engaged with the President, we've engaged with different departments in terms of the DGs as well, in terms of trying to follow up on these. And we've given them lists of all of those. We've, particularly on the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, we've engaged quite extensively with DGs and raise it at the meeting that the chair convened with the president and ourselves as commissioners with other ministers as well. So I think it's come from Parliament it will actually ensure that there definitely will be progress there. Thank you very much.
Yes,
sir.
Yeah. Well, what we have done is that quarterly, you know, we as Chapter 9 are meeting now, and Chapter 10, and one of the agreements is that in each of those meetings, we expect the International Relations and Justice to come and address us in terms of the treaties, how far have they gone, which one is outstanding. I did mention previously that since Deputy Minister Nell took over, you know, this function, there's a very big improvement in terms of moving forward at an international level, which was extremely bad. One of our staff, we have just given, she has a copy of where we are in each treaty and which department, and if we have time, I think she would be able to tell us, because we have gone a long way on that, because part of the problem was it was not known whether you go to environmental affairs or you go to the presidency, it was not clear. But now they finally consolidated who deals with what. So we have got a comprehensive document which set out all the treaties that are outstanding at what level. Although in terms of Africa, they are very bad in terms of reporting. I think we are far behind. So we have that. If later on, maybe after we've dealt with this particular one, she can briefly take you through on some of the issues, how far we have gone on that one.
Okay. This document, it's prepared by the Office of the Institute, the Speaker's Office. Is that on? But it's like your document.
No.
Am I on?
Documentation, yes.
You were not using them, Steve. Prepared by OISD, right? Yes.
I just wondered. But it's fine. It doesn't matter. Just
was we were thinking about our document. We'll be talking about that one.
Okay.
Which is I think they might summarize our document.
Just to say then, Chair, that we is an issue which you have been raising with us. It has been a concern. I think we do have an oversight function, and I do agree with what Mr. Jeffries has said, that when it comes to justice, we need to follow up. Now,
Chairperson, you have indicated that there has been improvement from since Deputy Minister, but still on this very international covenant on civil and political rights, 2000, and it's still outstanding. Now, at the conclusion of that report, it says South Africa has received negative attention of international human rights bodies, understandably, including bad reporting record to international bodies. Now, this is something that can't just continue unabated, and we need somehow, and I think you submitted a letter, to raise our concerns, because now it's 10 years later, third, fourth, other, this is an important document that needs to be responded to. Previously, I've had the experience when it comes to international conventions of raising it with the minister, and the minister has responded to say, we will cooperate, we will, and have done so. So there is a role that we as Parliament can play, working with that unit. But I think this is a very useful document. I don't know whether you've had sight of this document that is prepared by the unit in the Deputy's
office. I'm going to, she's got an appointment at 12:30 today with the doctor. So I want to afford Advocate an opportunity before she goes to address us.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members and colleagues from South African Human Rights Commission. Chairperson, perhaps I need to start by echoing the sentiments that were expressed by Honourable Jeffrey and yourself, sir, that the implications of what we had been receiving from Human Rights Commission sometimes give us an impression that they understand it, that they have to instruct the committee. And also even ourselves, we feel they seem to be thinking that we have the authority to instruct the committee as to what the committee should do. And Chair, one of the documents that we wrote to the Deputy Speaker responding to the correspondence written to us by the Commission was to indicate that our responsibility is to support and advise the committee, and that the committee, if the committee feels there is an area that they require clarification on from us in relation to any of the Chapter 9 institutions that report to the committee, we are ready as the office to come and work together with the committee. And secondly, Chair, the reports of the commission that relate to other government departments that are not the Department of Justice, we do agree with them that they don't seem to be receiving quite a great deal of attention in Parliament, and it's something that was raised even by the report of the late Professor Asmar. And what we have noticed internally is we are sitting and trying to understand what the challenges are exactly. We noticed that even the manner we had been referring their reports, we tended to refer them only for consideration, and something that has made it very difficult for committees to sit down and appreciate them and even report back to the House on them. Lately, what we have done, we have actually sat down, read the reports thoroughly, analyzed them and understand them as whether, in terms of content, they necessarily require the attention of this committee only. So that if they require the attention of this committee, we advise the Speaker to refer it to this committee, and if they require additional attention of other portfolio committees like international relations and even other portfolio committees in relation to other government departments that do not account to this committee, we have also advised that they be referred to those committees as well. Honourable Jeffrey referred to local government and the related organs of state, and that's what we are doing now to try and raise that particular attention to the reports that the Chapter 9. In fact, it's not only a problem that relates to Human Rights Commission only, it relates even to other Chapter 9s that do not report to Justice a Portfolio Committee Chair. I just thought that, let me share that one with you. And when it comes to the mandate of the office, I have indicated that we do understand that, amongst others, we have this responsibility of supporting this committee and also advising only the committee. And we also have been working on a session where everybody who had an interest in what this office has to be doing could be brought together to say what it is that they believe this office should be doing. So far what we have been doing is to, on an ad hoc basis, just come in and say we think this one relates to our committee and work on it. And again, when it comes to some of the concerns that were raised with us by Human Rights Commission, I remember in particular in relation to budgetary issues as well as international relations issues, I specifically had a meeting together with the Director General concerned. I also had a meeting with the Director General in the Presidency raising the plight of all the chapter 9s as well as the Human Rights Commission. And I remember at that time, Advocate Mushwana even came back to me and indicated that they had, after that meeting, some correspondence coming from, you know, departments like international relations and some chapter 9s, chair, because some of the decisions that are taken precisely as a result of the advices from the administrators that are taken by the ministers concerned. And after our meetings with those administrators in those departments, there had been some changes even in terms of the allocation of budgets in relation to the chapter 9 chairperson. That's what I wanted to say, chairperson. Thank you so much.
Maybe to wrap up the international side, and then we'll come back to Paya. But Chair, I mean, look, part of the problem was you just got this document, and I think it's a summary of Human Rights Commission's report. But what they have done, this is how the Advocate Secretarial Office, the Office on Institutions Supporting Democracy, is they've summarized the international treaties and the detail of what the problems are. And then they have recommendations, and that's recommendation per treaty. And some of them pertain to the Department of Justice and things that they're recommending that we do. And I think on those that it would be good if the committee could agree that you as the chair write to the minister or the DG, whichever is appropriate, but providing the detail to each of the treaties that the Department of Justice is responsible for, and that maybe that letter be drafted using this document from OISD, and then also with input from Human Rights Commission, I think, just to check that the facts are sort of accurate. So it would be things like ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and it's a problem of outstanding reports. I think that was the one Mr. Swat quoted going back to 2000 and the second and third periodic reports. So that a letter is drafted, I think, with input or with assistance from OSID and offered. No reaction. And the Human Rights Commission and SOC.
Okay. SOC, Deputy Chair. SOC. Having the creative port writer or which SOC?
That was Human Rights Commission. You're the Deputy Chair of SOC, so we can talk about... We can...
I knew that was coming.
Okay, we've got a new name. Chair, I'm not sure. I think I'll leave it to the Chair to respond to our new name.
I wanted to suggest that from the international side, that we will be doing that.
Okay.
And then obviously the report and then you have an engagement.
I assume that's a mandate from committee members. Yeah.
As you do that, maybe it will also be important to look at our final UPR response. Because if we remember, our country was in Geneva, where all of these treaties were raised by other countries. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot said about us. So if we can look at what the UPR is, I remember in our first response, this country said specifically there in the report that by the end of this year, we shall have ratified everyone. It's not us. It's what was said before the Human Rights Committee in Geneva. The council, yeah. Where we said, no, by the end of this year, everyone. I mean, we welcomed it, but we knew it would not be possible because each one of those need a lot of consultation. consultative processes, it's not just signing, but at least in their final report, then they come back to say, no, look, we are in the process. That's why now they've produced this document, which set out that at this particular period we're going to go there. So I just thought maybe to streamline this thing so that we don't write a lot of documents in isolation, because they have now consolidated everything into one document. It will be important to look into that for those who will be writing to the department. Thank you.
Okay, so that's UPR, right?
Yeah.
All right. All right, let's get back to Paya.
On some of the comments raised by Honorable Jeffries, we didn't mention PPI in our report because we are a bit formalistic in the way we reported. We looked at the period April 2011 to March 2012, and within that period, we didn't engage with Parliament on the Protection of Personal Information Bill. Prior to them, during that period, the Parliament had four technical committee meetings, and in that period, we never submitted the submission. The last submission we made to Parliament was on the 18th of November 2010, in direct response to a direct invitation from the chairperson to respond on certain provisions of Protection of Personal Information Bill. That is why we didn't mention PPI within this reporting period.
I guess it's better maybe just to leave it. I mean, okay. Maybe we should have, and
we recognize that we should have. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
And that's,
yes.
Maybe that's,
yes,
what you should,
yes,
say.
Yes, right. And in relation to amendments to PAYA,
I think also recognizing that Paula had actually just.
And in terms of amendments to PAYA, of all the provisions that I listed, the Protection of Personal Information Bill only amends Section 51. And in my presentation, I wasn't asking for the amendment of Section 51. What I was speaking about was a statement of clarity on Section 51. Given that Section 51 has been amended, we still have over a million manuals that have not been processed or reviewed. And what we are asking is, given the fact that the staff who are dealing with Section 51 are going to be leaving the Commission at the end of December, do we abandon that mandate in terms of reviewing these manuals?
No.
We've just converted some of the offices at the Commission into storage rooms at the moment. Yeah. But the problem is we've made a special request for funding of the data capturers just turned down. So there's simply nobody within the Commission that is going to be able to process the Section 51 manual starting from January.
I think they would have to extend the contract.
I mean, effectively, I mean, the amendment to Section 51 is that they must make the manuals must be compiled, but it's basically that it must be available
on the website,
not to be submitted.
Yeah.
Now, I would suggest you take a lead from our esteemed Supreme Court of Appeal, which has to read. To consider appeal petitions, they have to consider by law the but they have to consider by law the record of cases where there are petitions. The esteemed judges feel this is very onerous for them, and so they're not doing that. They're waiting for the law to be amended, and there's a criminal procedure amendment bill before us at the moment. But basically, effectively, they're not doing what they're statutorily obliged to do.
Yeah.
So I actually think you should follow the same. I mean, in fact, your case is stronger because this law has been through the National Assembly and its Section 75 bill. Therefore, you do not bother with reviewing the Section 51 manuals.
But I mean, that was the lead by the Supreme Court of Appeals.
So it's going to change. We did put in the different sections, because the problem with implementation, and I think in answer to the deputy chair of SARC's question, SARC, S-A-H,
SARC,
Human Rights Commission, okay. So she said this is poppy, which is, anyway, PPI. Anyway, different sections come into effect at different times. Obviously, and the Act has to be implemented within a year of the commencement date. Obviously, setting up the regulator is going to, I would imagine that the bill would be passed by the first quarter of next year. But then the commencement date is something else, and that will be, I think, largely up to the Department of Justice. And here we should maybe be asking them for a report on once the bill is passed. But it will be the appointment of the regulator, the establishment of the regulator. Then the Act is meant to be implemented within a year of the Act commencing, although that can be extended for a further 3 years by the Minister, which it probably would, given that, you know, just everything with implementation takes longer. So I think you're going to be with having PIUS still for a number of years. Now, unfortunately, I don't know whether, and it may be something, I don't actually honestly know the answer, whether the schedule, which is where the amendments to PIUS are, whether, I don't think that can all be implemented at the same time, but whether sections of the schedule can be implemented at different times. So, for example, once the Act commences, which will still probably be in a year or more, whether an amendment to Section 51 can take effect immediately or whether it would have to be dependent on the whole schedule. But there are other things in the schedule relating to the regulator itself, so I don't know what the answer to that would be. But I think the answer to the question is a question of time, and I think that's something you have to engage the Department with. And Chair, once the Act is passed by Parliament, we should maybe be asking the Department for an implementation report.
Yeah, the specific problem raised by the Commission, what they do with the date capturers that they've employed on a contract basis and whose contract expire at the end of December. So then the response is engage with the Department, ascertain from them those time periods and time frames, if you're able to.
My understanding is that is to go through the Section 51 reports. So what I'm suggesting is that given that the intention of Parliament is to ensure that Section 51 reports do not have to be submitted to anyone in future, that it would be better to follow the lead of the Supreme Court of Appeal and to leave it. And it's interesting that if you want more detail on the FCA's approach on this particular provision, which they're statutorily obliged to do but don't want to do because they say they don't have the time, it's too costly, etc., and they're then pushing for an amendment to the Criminal Procedure Act, which hasn't been passed yet by this committee, we're still debating how to approach it. This one is even further. You've got an amendment to Section 51 already. It just has to be passed by the MCOP and then back to us if there are further amendments. Not a case. It's basically it's this issue it's an amendment that was made that they had to consider the record of obtain the record where there's a petition.
And so the judge said, there's the record, I have it. Are you going to force me to read it? How will you force me to read it? Are you going to stand next to me? He says, I'm telling you now, I'm not going to read it. What do you do?
Basically, not implementing this section. And pushing, they say they are dealing with the more urgent appeals, petitions that look like they would succeed and things like that, but the bulk where they think actually the appellant has got no chance, they're not ordering the record. They're then pushing for this amendment, which is in the Criminal Procedure Amendment Bill, which has not yet passed this committee.
So that's what they're doing. So I don't know. I think the situation is quite analogous to the one you're facing. And in fact, on the amendment to Section 51, you're more advanced because that amendment has gone through the National Assembly.
Thank you for that clarity.
So that's something you can say amongst yourselves and decide.
And on the question of having more detail about the compliance audits, what we did with regards to the consolidated audit report that is annexed is we highlighted findings and made detailed recommendations on the audits over the last 5 years of the First Republic institutions. If you want more detail with regards to specific institutions, we've got those. It will just be a bit bulky to report in Parliament. So,
on that, I think it would be useful to have the material on the Department of Justice.
Okay.
Because they're the committee. They're the department we perform oversight over, and so the detail of where the problems are would be useful.
Okay.
Just on that department.
All right. Thank you. And on last night, disputing our reports to them, that LASA can't dispute that allegations because we specifically showed them that they reported on Section 32. There was a particular prior request that they omitted, and we sent this request to them, asking them to specifically report on it. What LASA disputed with us was a question of interpretation. We insisted to them that prior request should have been reported in this reporting period because it only does this in this reporting period. And they insisted that it should have been reported in the last reporting period, which they didn't do. And then they were now asking to go and amend Section 32 reports for the last reporting period. And we were a bit headstrong when we insisted that our interpretation of prior was the accurate one.
They were a bit headstrong. Yeah. I can see Vidu being headstrong.
I'm not worried too much about the timing. What worries me is this sentence: the Commission engaged with LASA and remains concerned about the accuracy of Section 32 reporting by LASA.
Because we sent emails to the corporate services head of LASA, and we spoke to him about the inaccurate reporting, and what he kept on getting from them was a disagreement with us on the interpretation of the law. And we explicitly told them that even if you disagree with our interpretation of the law, we want you to report based on our interpretation of the law, and they simply refused to do so.
I think on this one it would be useful to get, the detail as well, exactly what, and then we can put it to LASA when they come
something
back.
Something in writing, please.
It's better.
If it involves that certain individual, then I'm not sure, are we, is it sub judice? It does apply. I don't know. We need to discuss this. You see, because this was a question that rose to my mind while I was reading the report, that people may use PAIA, knowing full well that they're going to approach the courts and get an unfair advantage. But of course, you know, as far as you're concerned, you're going to follow the law and insist that people comply. But as far as this gentleman is concerned, I'm not going to name him because I don't want to give him an unfair advantage. He's made it clear he's going to court. And LASA has said, fine, we'll see you there. Now, do we become involved in the matter? We can't. You see, that's the problem we're faced with, Mr. Adelaide. All right. Yeah. That's the difficulty we're facing. All right. He applied for a position. He was interviewed together with others, and someone else was appointed, and he agreed. Well. All right. Can Can we leave that matter there?
Yeah. Okay, all right. Okay, thank you. Thank you for that clarity.
Ms. Adams, do you want to come in on this?
Yes, I just have one question. In terms of the Northwest, so you haven't been compliant for the last 3 years, okay? And on your website itself, you talk about non-compliant and that private as well as public bodies should in fact comply with this act. And specifically, you make reference to Section 90. So, and then today you come here and you state that, yes, the Commission has been reluctant to use its powers. So now my question is plain and simple. It seems like, I just want to know, why should we then take you serious? Because if you do have powers, you're not using it. You give us long reports to read, and the reports... Oh, that is romantic now. A romantic setting. You give us very long reports, and as you stated at the beginning, it's not even the first report. I mean, for 3 years, the Northwest, and Northwest is just one example. There are many government departments that you also refer to. So my question is really, why are we wasting time? I mean, should we even bother to continue reading these reports? Because it seems like next year it's going to be Northwest for the first time. And I'm disappointed because this act has been passed 12 years ago. You come here and says very gently that, yeah, we've been reluctant and we will improve. But quite frankly, it's 12 years now. My sisters will not read these reports then. Thank you.
In other words, Ms. Adams is saying subpoena them. And this one. Sure.
Thank you for that. The recommendation for amending Section 90 to allow us to enforce non-compliance on Section 32 reporting was made in the context of the Commission will soon no longer be responsible for PAYA, and the independent, the information regulator will have very wide powers that allows all manners of enforcement on both PAYA and the Protection of Personal Information Bill. And it will be useful that given the independent regulator will be coming in, information regulator will be coming in with these very strong powers, then having powers in terms of Section 90, which the Commission currently doesn't have, it will be useful for the information regulator to have those powers to be able to deal with this issue of non-compliance by the provincial offices.
Are you saying that we must just leave everything as is and wait until for better days? Because it seems like these provisions in the Act, you cannot enforce it. From my side, it seems
we
like...
In terms of our power, in terms of power, we cannot enforce it.
Isn't that for the court to decide that?
If power does not give the Commission powers to enforce certain non-reporting obligations, the best we can do in terms of our part, in terms of PAYA, is to constantly write to them seeking their cooperation in terms of enforcement.
Yes, but the sections 92 and 3, I'm sure it wasn't just written for the fun of it. Surely it is for compliance. And my question is, if the Human Rights Commission is there to make sure that there is compliance when it comes to this act, isn't it at the end of the day the court that must decide whether there is a problem with those specific provisions or not? And not for us to come with all these academic and long debates and discussions, but really to go to court, because quite frankly, if a province like the Northwest is not complying for 3 years, somebody needs to be blamed. So it's either the portfolio committee, it's either the Human Rights Commission or Parliament, but we cannot now say, well, this has not been, this is a problem, these provisions, and we're waiting for better days for these provisions to be amended, and then we will actually comply with it.
No, we simply can't take a government department to court. Before you can establish a dispute between.
All right, Chairperson Mishwani?
Yeah, I thought we dealt with it. To say, you know, in some of these matters, we have not done everything within our powers. And I did say it would be good for us, while we request you or we accept what you're going to do, to also do our part. You see, we don't have to request them. I mean, we have the powers. So it's only when we have used all of those powers that maybe we'll come back to you.
But Chairperson, that is really the point. When is that going to happen?
That's what I said. To say, look, I don't want to attend this committee. In other words, I said the ball is in our court to go and do exactly what you are saying.
All right. I believe I've answered your question with regard to the clarity on section 25% of compliance audits.
Well, you said it was in terms of the compliance audits you'd done.
Yes.
Presumably you checked a sample. How did it work?
The 43 institutions that we audited, of those 43 institutions, only about 11 of them had Deputy Information Officers. That's what our public officials knew about.
That's on the Information Officers, which is Deputy Information Officers,
yes,
which is easy to measure. You also then made a comment that people didn't know 25% public servants weren't aware. That's the one I'm trying to get clarity as to how did you get to that figure. Because that presumably would mean interviewing or finding out from every public servant whether they know or don't know.
No, public servant in those 43 institutions. When in conduct and compliance audits, we bring in staff officials from records management, from the communications unit, from legal services, and frontline staff. So we bring in the core staff that they require. And when we interview these core staff during the compliance audits, they don't know what prior procedures are or where that institution has a deputy information officer.
Okay, so it's not 25% of all public servants.
No.
It's 25% of the staff dealing with PAYA in those departments.
Yes. Who are supposed to be responsible for PAYA in those departments.
And that just happens to be the same figure as those that don't have deputy information officers.
Yes.
Okay, I mean, I'm still not sure of the accuracy, because one would have expected a higher level of understanding at least than those that don't have deputy information officers, but yeah, I can leave it, I think, for now.
Okay. On the question of whether we support the removal of the training of magistrates, I think this condition was introduced because PAYA is a very technical law, and you want to have judicial officers who are well-versed in terms of the application of the law, recognizing when a government department legitimately applies an exemption in terms of granting access information or not. So while removing the condition for training would certainly aid the application to magistrate courts in terms of PAYA, I would be reluctant to completely remove that condition, because applying PAYA and interpreting PAYA is only better when you have judicial officers who can expand the substantive and procedural interpretation of the law.
Yeah.
What would be helpful perhaps would be to get the Parliament to ask Department of Justice to ask the Staff and Judicial Education Institute to fast track the training process.
Well, Chair, I mean, it's something, if I can just come in, even though Ms.
You should say that right at the outset.
Yeah, but I mean, it's something we have been asking the Department for. We haven't had the Institute yet, but I just noticed from the Act that, you know, the section wasn't in the original Act, in PAYA as originally passed. It then got added, it's 91A, got added in 2002. So maybe Mr. Swart can remember, I can't. But so somewhere along the line it was thought after the Act was passed that no, these judicial officers need to be trained. But I mean, I think it's something, Chair, we've got to engage more. I've been the one, I'm glad Mr. Schaefer's now joining me. I've been one who's been perpetually questioning over the last year the department.
the department around the implementation of 91A.
The need for training. Okay. You said something about romantic just now. Well, is it the commissioners or is it Sergey? So can we, the two of you, Mr. Swart and Mr. Schaefer, ask you to address it at the commission level? No, we're going to leave it to both of you. Mr. Sibonioni, your appointment to Sergey, is it confirmed now? Okay, but it doesn't stop us from asking you what's happening at Sergey. And so whilst we are mandating both Mr. Swartz and Mr. Schaefer to take it up at the commission level, can we ask you whether or at what point this matter can be raised at Sergey? Please. Fairly much. Why can't I just write to Sergey? Yes, Mr. Jeffrey.
It's helpful, 91A.
Helpful?
Helpful.
Oh, okay.
The Chief Justice must, in consultation with the JSC and the Magistrates Committee, which the Honourable Schaefer is on, develop the content of training courses with a view to building its clause section 91A. Develop the content of training courses with a view to building a dedicated and experienced pool of trained and specialised presiding officers for purposes of presiding in all proceedings. The Chief Justice must, in consultation with the JSC, the Magistrates Commission and the Minister, and the Magistrates Commission is what Mr. Schaefer is on, implement the training courses. Okay. Number 7, the Minister's Table of Report in Parliament is prescribed relating to the content and implementation of training courses referred to. I think you should ask the Minister to table his report.
All right.
91A, right
again,
91A, sub
7. Yes, I'll do that. And then I think I must also send a DG a letter. No, I think asking her in terms of 3B. But of course, I doubt if any magistrates have completed any courses.
Who said they had gone untaken training?
Really?
Maybe the Honourable Schaefer can give us a report. Each chief of the commission, magistrates' commission, to what the involvement has been.
All right. There's a bit of work for us to do there, regardless of whether the Human Rights Commission is going to be relieved of higher duties or not. We still need to do follow up on this. Okay, so the magistrates will be trained. So that answers that question. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
All right.
And on the question about whether we've engaged with the public protector on fire complaints, we've received files from the public protector that have been referred to us. We deal with and we've dealt with those, but we've not had a partnership to deal with the specific complaints together with regard to fire.
Just repeat that again. Sorry.
We have received files from the public protector to deal with fire complaints, but we've never had a partnership to deal with the specific complaints together.
Why not?
The opportunity has never arisen. I'm speaking with regards to fire. Well, the complaints that we've often received have been simple enough for the commission to deal with alone.
Okay. There was a question.
And what we have done to engage with the Department of Justice on an annual basis when we table our recommendations on PIA, we often follow up with those recommendations by asking the Department of Justice to give us an update on the recommendations we've made and steps that have been taken to address those recommendations. But all those recommendations and letters that we sent to the Department of Justice have simply been met with a mute response. We haven't had mute response. We haven't had anything from them. I believe what we can do as a secretariat might be to ask the deputy chairperson perhaps engage on behalf of the secretariat with the minister on the recommendations we have tabled. On the protection of state information bill as it's currently passed by the NCOP. Yes.
Mario.
We welcome the fact that Chapter 9 institutions like the Commission would now have access to classified information. And we also welcome the fact that PIA has been reinstated as the supreme law guiding access to information. Perhaps what would need to be clarified would be the public would be information regulator is not a Chapter 9 institution. So when the information regulator becomes active, will they have the same powers as Chapter 9 institutions to be able to access classified information in their work? We also welcome the fact that a classification review panel and some form of public interest has been introduced into the law, but our concerns with regard to the classification review panel would be the fact that members of public would not be able to make submissions to that panel when seeking the declassification of information. And also with regard to the public interest test.
Is that a fact?
It, that's my understanding.
Have they done something to honor?
I'm not aware that that's how it reads.
That's not the way we wrote it.
Okay.
Not the way
I see. All right. The public interest test, we are happy that that's been introduced to it, and the concerns broadly surrounding the protection of state information bill would be perhaps little issues dealing with wording that might be subject to abuse in interpretation. For instance, the issue of national security, which includes exposure of a state security matter that goes against a constitutional order, I think that could be interpreted broadly to perhaps include things that are not that the drafters didn't envisage. And yes. And also issues surrounding national security itself, where national security is not defined to mean something, but to include a list of things. So those are the nitty-gritty issues that we hope that before it is finally passed would be addressed by the NA.
Can I just ask, in your view, is it still unconstitutional then, in retrospect?
We think that there's room for improvement.
I think it's
I think just before, and I think in relation to the questions that have been raised about what is the Commission's view, particularly around the issue of unconstitutionality, I think the Chair is absolutely correct when he said earlier that the Commission will engage this discussion as commissioners and as the head of the programme involved to make a decision, and we will actually pronounce on our decision.
And
we haven't done that yet. And so to very serious issues which we will actually engage in proper advice on as well. Thanks very much.
Yeah, sorry, and I misspoke a minute ago. Is that the Legislative Safety Security Matter for this? Because that's what makes that portion of the difference. Sorry, the bill, the amendments are in the ATC. I think it would be better that members look at the amendments rather than trying to get the amendments from the Human Rights Commission.
Is there now a poll, JJ?
Look, I haven't seen a printed bill. I don't know what they do with NCFP amendment, but in the ATC, they have a comprehensive report which details the amendments to each section. So that read with the NA bill.
Yeah, that's awkward.
Still, we can't ask them.
No, I'm not saying we must. Yeah. I'm not saying we must. It just makes very difficult reading. Anyway, all right.
Yes, they have.
So you've heard Deputy Chair Governor's response that they will meet as a commission, and yeah, so I think that's fair. Yeah.
On a result of whether Parliament has to report on Section 32, from our interpretation of a public body in terms of PAYA, we believe PAYA applies to it's worded in a way that one could say it only applies to executive arm of government.
So just in your report, you indicated that Parliament had not submitted the Deputy report.
Yes, and
that's why we just maybe in our Parliament hasn't had.
The reports come to prior requests come to Parliament, and Parliament has an information officer. So from our position, Parliament has to submit Section 32 reports to us, and they haven't done so in the reporting period as well.
Just in this area.
In the previous period, I'm not certain.
So they stand to be summoned. What? Only the information officer. Okay. All right. Mr. Jeffrey?
No, I mean, I think it's quite clear. I mean, public body means any other, okay, Department of State or Administration, then B, any other functionary or institution when exercising a power or performing a duty in terms of the Constitution. And
Parliament is one of those.
Yeah. Why didn't you put in your annual report?
Because we have the structure that we've been given in terms of power. We report on national departments, provincial departments, municipalities, and Chapter 9 institutions and other bodies. It's an omission on our part not to put Parliament under other bodies.
Okay, and then what about the Ministry of Legislatures?
We haven't received any reports from
provincial legislatures. Why did you report on the compliance of provincial legislatures too?
We've largely focused our attention on the executive because on public departments, because we are trying to monitor substantive compliance, and we feel a lot of requests will go to public departments rather than legislature.
Perhaps if you also...
Yeah, they won't get supported for
the money. No, perhaps if you included the legislatures, that would bring to the minds of the legislators the importance of PAYA. Perhaps. So think carefully about it. Who's Parliament's information officer? The secretary?
No,
the secretary?
Secretary to Parliament. Deputy Secretary. Okay, there you have it then.
Are you sure though? Because usually the Deputy Information Officer is a lower
mid-level.
Yeah, mid-level. So the Information Officer will be the DG of the Government Department.
Yeah, not compliant.
The more junior official,
still
not the DG.
They're not compliant.
I mean, it's shocking that we won't send it there.
No, we must ask him, why hasn't he complying?
Even in tears are not compliant.
No, we've got to ask him why he hasn't been complying.
The other chapter 9, are you compliant?
Yes.
You are, okay. And how do you protect that?
Yes.
They're compliant.
They're compliant.
I don't know the Deputy Information Officer, but Information Officer will be the CEO.
Yes, obviously. That's why I'm asking you the FDA. I mean, they're appointed to the Information Officer.
They have. I don't. In the report they submitted to us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alright. The staff also asked us about our engagement with other important stakeholders like the Legal Resources Center. Yes.
If the Chair would like to just speak to the particular of litigation and costs and clearing costs with other institutions.
Ah, yes. Legal Resources Center, etc.
Because we have discussed this matter, so.
Yeah, I was not sure whether we need to discuss this, but we do share resources. For instance, they will assist us, for instance, in terms of drafting papers, but when it comes to the actual hearing where, for instance, you need senior counsel or something, then it comes back to us. And I have to share that. Well, conflict of interest depends. We are not only talking about the case which was here before, but we do have other cases where there is no hint of conflict of interest. Like, for instance, in the Lanesia matter, they've got their own clients, and we have got people who came to us. So those people do not necessarily share the same. I mean, much as they are the people who also invaded the land, they do not necessarily do that in collaboration with the others. Others have got their own reasons. Others, for instance, went in there because they did not even know they were being deceived by public officials. They got clear deed of grants, which some government officials are now being tried and others have been sentenced. So you have a lot of categories of people in that respect. Yes.
And I just want to ask questions about records management and problems. From page 43 of our consolidated audit report, we deal with our findings on record management with public institutions, and specifically with this issue of file plans. In our findings we did indicate that some institutions indicated that file plans are in place, but some of these appear to be outdated with no amendments or additions done, or have simply not been submitted to archives for approval. And some also admitted that they in fact have no file plans at all, and most of the institutions indicated that they had deviated from the file plans in instances where they had been approved in terms of the actual records being generated, and they encountered varying levels of resistance from staff to comply with the proper use of the systems. And also in some of the audits that we've done, the approach to classification has been a mixed bag. Some have used the Archives Act, while some are following MIS in terms of classification of information. And that is where I believe the potential state information bill comes in to regulate this issue of classification.
Because more often than not, what you found is because records have been classified haphazardly and there is no coordinated approach to it, that has also affected how prior requests have been dealt with. An example would be the Department of Energy, where the Deputy Information Officer told us that when they are trying to consider prior requests, they don't even have access to the information to determine whether it should be released or not, because they don't have they are not on the appropriate level to have access to such classified documents. So they reject information requests based simply on what senior officials have told them, without they having the opportunity to make the judgment call whether it can be released in terms of prior or not. And so the question of whether such information can be disclosed in terms of the public interest, or whether the discretion on the information officer to decide whether it should be released, whether an exemption applies or not, does not even arise in that instance.
Yeah, and the fact that the protection of state information now perpetuates the mixture of, it's not just classification, it deals with plain, fine record keeping. And the fact that it's now perpetuating that intermix of classification and ordinary record keeping is just going to presumably perpetuate this exact problem, isn't it? Is it just, what's your page reference 43? Is it, do you mean in this document? I didn't, oh. No, I've got. Oh, all right, that's it. Because I'm borrowing. It's 23, isn't it?
43.
No, I think we haven't got the same document. But all right, thank you for that. So my interest would still be.
It wasn't, so I'm just wondering where they are.
We sent 60 yeah. of this in October.
Yeah, it may very well be in my office with my bias, but I've come in from, not sure, from my office. Now, I would still remain interested if in the course of your further work, you wanted to look at what people are using for plain old-fashioned record keeping, because we have a conflicting situation there. You have the National Archivist, who's been chased away, writing the regulations. Also have lists. Also have the protection of state information threatening to come in with similar powers for the minister or for the first time statutory. So somebody should be keeping an eye on this, and it's really only you to be doing it.
I think certainly the commission, in terms of our little examination of the act, will bear that in mind and will actually.
What we could do is, given the fact that we do an annual Golden Key research, the specific focus of our Golden Key research for next year can be on the record keeping, and then I can give you those findings.
If you could just pause there. Honourable members, it's nearly 12:30. Do we break for lunch and reconvene? All right.
Sorry, Chair, I'm done with the responses to the question.
You're done with the responses? Oh, okay. Given that he's done with the responses, well, there you go. You see.
Honourable, if you can think about it.
Oh, you don't. You don't want to, even if you have. All right.
So, look, I think
the question is really, do we proceed and complete?
I think we want to complete,
right.
And even if we go on slightly into
that's fine.
After
that's
one,
the question
but, I think we've got too much more. I we've got a responsibility here, and
You know, I know this all comes in late, moans at the Human Rights Commission and then wants to go early.
You're in trouble there.
I think, Chair, in terms of what we do, I think it's clear that, I mean, look, there's one thing I noticed that you don't have, you've just got your, or on my report, I don't know if we're dealing with different ones, but on the Section 32 replies, just deal with yourselves and the Public Service Commission. You don't mention any other Chapter 9.
Yes, because though they have complied, they didn't give us the Chapter 32 reports within the deadline. That's why they're not in these reports. They sent us the Section 32 reports and the other details on compliance after the deadline.
Yeah, but it's that we need to, that we're not compliant then, that we need to know. I mean, it's not a big issue, but one would expect the Chapter 9s to be, and Parliament, to be more than compliant. And, I mean, you told us, I think the Honourable Adams wasn't here, I think that a couple of North West departments have now complied. Am I right? Yes. So, you know, it sorry?
No, North Cape.
North Cape, still no North West. Okay. But anyway, you know, it there's a cut-off. And it would be useful to know the compliance of all the Chapter 9s, the Commission with the long name, gender, Auditor General, etc. Okay. Then, Chair, I think the issue is, I mean, the suggestion that I've made is that we, I mean, there is on page 36 this list of non-compliant national departments.
Yes.
Presumably that is accurate. And I think the suggestion, Chair, would be that we adopt a report expressing concern and calling on the relevant minister to report to the House within a reasonable period. The Section 14 compliance is more complicated because I, for example, don't know what the difference between, if you look at your accessibility chart, you know, what's the difference between easily accessible, good, fairly easy, simple, you know, you've got different...
It's the website, isn't it?
It's basically, yeah, the accessibility of their manual, which is on the website, but I mean... You. I don't know what grading you're using, but please tell me what is the difference between fairly easy, simple, good, fairly difficult, obviously, on the other side. Can't you have one sort of standard needs improvement, fine, very good, you know, something like that. But I mean, is easy accessible better than simple, better than easy? Yes, okay. But now, when it comes to what should we report on the Section 14 compliance, I think it's obvious you've raised the thing about when it was updated. So you point to, I think, Home Affairs are never updated. They don't have a... Well, I suppose it would be issues of which, who doesn't have a Section 14 manual? Everybody's got a website.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Haven't they? Yes, they have.
Just about everyone.
Everybody's got
the national departments, everybody has.
Yes, everybody has. I'm talking just about national. But in a number, I think we'd report on the, Chair, I would suggest that we report on those that don't have a Section 14 manual, and then they haven't updated it. I don't know what period we should use, what's your suggestion for that, since 2010 or 20...
Well, PIAS is annually.
Annually. Okay, yeah. Well, then it's basically the non-compliance with that, and unfortunately I think it's only justice and sports and recreation.
That have updated it,
and environmental affairs. I think then that should be what the report that we do. I did have some other broader issues on money, not with PIA. I don't know if there's any more anybody else wants to raise at PIA. I'm getting like really scared looks here. I don't even want to look at them.
I didn't realize the scared looks worried you. What about money? What about money?
No, Chair, it was just the issue of, we did ask for more money from, have we finished with PIA?
Yes, well, the money for PIA is...
No, I'm talking about money for Human Rights Commission.
Ah, okay. All right.
Just to use the opportunity, Chair.
Yeah, let's raise it.
No, Chair, we asked for sort of a better budget, which they did the 22nd of October. We put into our... BRR report that we thought the Human Rights Commission should get more money. We were particularly concerned about the issue of the commissioners not being able to travel.
Yeah.
A budget's been provided for that. Now, I understand the Treasury has just said no.
Really?
I think the Human Rights Commission got a letter. I don't know if there's a response from, I think the Treasury not responded, but I think, Chair, we've got to, you know, pursue it. And I think it's in the context of you know, a public protector, SIU, you know, it seems to be that if Treasury think you're
sexy,
apologies, SARC obviously is not sexy.
We'll try and give the chair a makeover.
The chair, I think we need to, I just while they're here, I think that the budget that they provided was very useful.
Mm.
I don't want them to think, as Advocate Adams had raised in another context, that they're just sort of submitting stuff to us and nothing happens. And I think we need to pursue it with the Appropriations Committee. Because last time I think their response to the Human Rights Commission was no, they they thought they could just manage their money better, and it's just not good enough.
Just enlighten me, Mr. Jeffrey. When I'm ignorant of these things, I ask: should the Treasury not have responded to us? Because after all, it's our BRRR report. It's not the Commission's report. It's ours.
Yeah, but there was.
I think they did respond to Parliament, which was basically...
There should be one in terms of the present financial year. I haven't seen anything.
I think the issue is, and to raise while particularly the Chair and the Deputy Chair are here, I mean, we can't let this matter rest. I think it's both the issue of the more funds and the issue of the percentage cuts. Because I really think they are working at the bone, and I think that, I mean, what I like with Human Rights Commission is, look, I don't necessarily always agree with what you do, I won't go into detail on that. But I mean, when it comes to complaints, they don't take every complaint, they assess the complaints. And I think it's a thing of we need to pursue it through the budget process in Parliament. And I hope the committee would agree with that.
Before I recognize you, Advocate Shwana, what Mr. Jeffrey is saying is true, and we shouldn't make light of it. We have noticed this, that there are certain entities, I don't want to name them. It's not their fault. I mean, they seem to be delivering. And because they are delivering, Treasury then is easily amenable to granting or persuaded to granting them more funding. Now, that's a bit unfair to you, because you could argue quite adequately that you're also delivering. But in the eyes of Treasury, they don't see it. And that's our difficulty with the process. And perhaps at some point we would need to engage with Treasury. They did offer to do so, but somehow that hasn't seen the light. They wanted to send us someone who was going to analyze the Department of Justice. Was it in relation to the Department of Justice? They've had a cut of $600 million. Now, as far as the House is concerned, that's huge. That's enormous. So, just understand it in that context. Chairperson Mashona.
Yeah, maybe we need to thank the committee, really, for having tried what they did. And despite the fact that Treasury maybe decided not to grant the money, but we really appreciate what the committee has done, and we thank you for that. We, you know, we took stock, you know, trying to look at our provinces. You know, you find a province like KwaZulu-Natal, for instance, and Eastern Cape, which are huge rural areas. And you try and look at the number of complaints that come to that office, whether really it's worth even employing people to be in that office. And the crux of the matter is that you are not able to reach out to the people out there. And the question is, how do you deliver in a situation like that? it's easier if you look, the majority of our complaints are in Western Cape, here in town. There are cases around Western Cape, not even outside, except for a few farmers. And you also have Gaut. Those are the two most populated in terms of complaints. But where you have to go out and reach out to the people who are really needy, you are not able to go there. Because, for instance, you only have one person who is an outreach officer. And you ask yourself if you have that person sitting in KZN, in Eastern Cape, in the Limpopo, what are you going to do? And if you have maybe made an observation, you will find that the human right is not growing, because growing means you must bring in more cases, you must be able to reach out to the people. And we are completely tied. I mean, I just find us operating merely on salaries. You know, if you look at the money that we get, we're there just to pay out salaries. And now you have, recently you have this spate of cases which necessarily want you to go to court. And we rely on pro bono, some of whom are not always available, you know, from one pro bono to the other. And I don't think human rights are that cheap. You know, when rights of the people are trodden, they are not cheap. I mean, take Lanesia. I mean, we regretted why others thought we should not have gone to Lanesia, because we don't know what we are doing. But if you look at it closely, that those people were deceived by officials from government, and they've got a deed of grants which tells them that this is your property. And now you see a grader going to demolish their houses. You ask yourself, do we have to wait and see that thing happen? So I think we need maybe a debate around this issue as to what do we mean by not delivering. Because I surely do not understand. Sometimes I think we are just paying people in, let's say, Northwest, for instance. We find that there are very few cases, but now they begin to increase, but you don't have the capacity to deal with those cases. So I'm not trying to influence you, I'm just saying, look, whoever is making that judgment surely must hear us as well. Not that we motivate for any other thing, but I'm not sure how far they understand the difficulties that are going on, just sitting in the office like officials. We want to go out, we don't want to sit in the office.
I think I just want to add to what the Chair has said about that, because I think with each success that the Commission achieves, so for example, if it successfully has water and sanitation hearings in 8 provinces, out of each of those hearings, people who come to it are excited about what the Commission is about, they're learning about the Commission, and they want to make complaints. So there's large numbers of complaints. I mean, the last hearing we had here in the Western Cape, there were queues outside those tables for people waiting to make complaints. And the provincial manager in this province, for example, said that it'd be great actually if we had the resources to be able to regularly go to rural areas and hold clinics. So we're able to address the complaints that people have, but there isn't resources to do that. So there is a crying need for some people to actually say, you know, we want to know how we address our human rights, and we want to actually come to the Commission with these complaints, or we want the Commission to come to us. But that means that you have to think about the resources differently. And I think Treasury needs to understand how the Commission operates. And the kind of what is meant by human rights in this country today, and how critical it is. Because I think that thing of thinking short term and thinking long term is a real problem of budget makers. There's the issue of if people feel confident in Chapter 9 institutions and come to Chapter 9 institutions with their complaints and see those complaints being resolved, they don't have to take to the streets. They're being heard, the things are actually, they're bringing to those hearings. People and civil society organizations like the Social Justice Coalition, for example, who were present at the hearing said it was unprecedented that we had managed to get local, provincial and national government representatives there to listen for the whole day to what people were saying. needed to be changed and were ready to respond. So that sort of engagement is something that people want, and it's important if we're going to address human rights substantively that we need the kinds of resources to get our staff who are very willing to do it. The staff in the commission are really hardworking and want to actually do the best of to their ability, and they need the kind of backup to enable to do that. Thanks, Chair.
We'll need to find a way of how we're going to engage with Tricia. I don't...
No, we're going to decide.
Okay, all right. Committee to committee?
Mm-hmm.
We meet with them chair to chair? Every time I engage with him, he wants to run away.
Okay, then
all right. We're not going to give you any promises. We'll try our level best. I don't know her. Ms. Barbara Swartz is Parliament's Acting Deputy Information Officer. Do you know her?
No.
I don't know her. Legal advisor. Okay. I must seek out.
Okay, well now we
know. Yes, yes. Should we not do a letter to them first? The secretary has changed. We have a new secretary. And he may take offense that we're blaming him for stuff that was done by his predecessor.
Well, maybe we'll just ask why have they complied? What,
sure.
What have they done about...
Yeah. Yeah, it's Ms. Barbara Swartz, the deputy. Yes. I don't know her. I don't know her.
During the child justice act, I didn't see the notice from Mr. Romano, but I mean, he assured me that the officials are all coming.
All right, I think we've covered everything in your report, Chairperson Mishwana, and then it's for me to thank you, to thank Deputy Chair, Prex Governor, Mr. Adeleke, the rest of your staff in your commission. I hope I'm saying staff and I'm not leaving out any commissioners, for being here today. The banter you're hearing is because most of us, after last week, assumed that's it, we're done for the year, and off we went. And of course someone on the committee decided, no, hang on a second. There's still this report that we haven't interrogated. Well, one day I'll show you the SMSs I got in response to my... that we're coming back today. You know, they weren't very complimentary. But be that as it may. No, I think it was appropriate that we meet with you and interrogate your report. I hope we've done justice to it. I'm sure that the next year there's going to be another report, which we must interrogate. Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Jeffrey.
Not the commission, but the program, and seriously, presumably there will be a program worked out. I mean, the things that we haven't done is the Child Justice Act and the Sexual Offences Act.
Right.
We also need to have a date for hearings for the Legal Practice Bill. We need to start on that.
Yeah.
No, we need to be giving it now so that people... Well, I mean, people have made submissions, but it would be in... Because we're going to have other legislation. You know, we've got the one that they want, which is the...
Yes. 21 pieces.
Well, we've got the backed up, the
but honourable members, in response to Mr. Jeffrey, we thought that we should have a strat plan session first thing in the new year, which will set out our programme. I hear what you're saying about the legal practice bill, and I agree with you. And then everyone in the committee will then understand what our programme for the year is.
But Chair, I think can we at least legal practice, not now, but before
the
new year. Set dates for the hearings, because that bill's not a The department or people keep telling you different things, but I think it's not a simple bill, and you need legal practice, and we need to make sure that we are able to complete it. I mean, we're usually taking a year longer on complex legislation. We need to complete it before the election.
Well, it's also very controversial. Yeah, very controversial, and we're going to be hammered.
I would suggest that we do set a date for the public hearings sort of soon after the FAT meeting.
Well, have the documents. Well, now that you've raised legal practice, you remember initially we set a closing date and then we decided no, it's unreasonable. So, do we simply say that, well, whatever it was, whoever responded, we'll just put them in the hearings, or should we say right now there is a date?
I think the issue is that we only want those people who want to come and speak to us. That's those who've asked. Okay, I think it would be, we'd need to sort of have probably an advert for hearings out now this year, because otherwise people will complain they got it late and things. And it would be this date for the hearing. Anyone who wants to come, please contact the secretary.
There may not be money. We have the same problems as you. We've exceeded our budget way in June already. We may have to make do with a statement, a media statement.
Do you know how contentious this thing is going to be?
It's already contentious.
Yes. But so can we not just suddenly now sit here and decide, oh, we must now start doing it early next year and let's find a date? Do this thing slowly and with deliberation. Are we not already in the situation where the bar and the law societies are developing a joint position? Were we not expecting that? Yes? No?
No.
Has that changed?
If you read the latest issue of Readers, where is she? There is she.
Yeah.
It seems like they're not going to reach consensus right? Between the two bodies.
Is that right? Because there was a date for that.
They thought they would, but it's...
Do you confirm that the link with that is that the fact that the Parliament, I mean, I know it's something that the Deputy Minister raised with me, and I'd also raised, I think he raised with you, of wanting the parliamentary process to, even though it could be postponed, but to have dates set. So the pressure would be put on the law bodies to reach agreement. If there's no pressure, then they don't have to reach an agreement. So I do think, Chair, I'm quite shocked that there isn't enough money, and maybe that's something one can look at afterwards. If we can do an effort, great, otherwise in the statement. But let's
speak to Mr.
Because this is a crucial bill. Let's set a date and let's, for the hearings, and we must start with the bill. And then Law Society can convey that to their members and onto the Bar Council if they feel like it, or they can leave the Bar Council out and hopefully it's an undue advantage.
Mr. Sibanyoni?
Yeah. Chairperson, you will recall that we gave some opportunity to the health profession by not continuing with the bill, hoping that they would reach some consensus. But we knew that they will not reach 100% consensus among themselves. And then, therefore, I think we should proceed as soon as possible. As a practitioner, my experience outside there is that people want the bill to be legislated. And then also, you recall last time when I said, let us strike the rebus, because the rebus is read by the all practitioners. It went to one us.
I know.
And yes, maybe as the Honorable Smart is saying, if there is a real statement, and if there is some little balance, just advertise the rebus and let it continue.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. Advocate Mishwana.
No, I just want to steal this moment. I don't want to say I opened my computer while I did, but our institution was due for accreditation. You know, every 5 years they assess you. So as I was paging here, I see we have been re-accredited as an A status.
A status.
This is APAC, Human Rights Committee.
Yes.
Well done.
But what happened to your African citizen did that go through?
Yes, we are talking over the president.
Lovely.
But the one issue that they emphasize is the one that our Act, the Human Rights Act, does not say what is our role at an international level.
Can we please clean up? The stuff that is languishing on the statute book and making life impossible for people. Before we now leap into the contentious thing, with Honourable Deputy now, 71, or February, it's nonsense. We have got, it is now, how many years since your act was in 1994? It was the first act ever done in the Democratic Parliament. Now, that is number one for next year.
As a commission, we strongly support the committee in ensuring that the Act is sorted out and finalised, so that it addresses the reality that the commission had to deal with.
Just to point out, Honourable Smart, that we have two bills before us. One is the criminal procedure bill that we're working on, and the other one is the legal practice bill. We do not have so if she wants to propose a private members bill or a committee bill.
But the legal practice bill is before us.
I would imagine that it's been tabled. I mean, it's got a number. Whereas the Human Rights Commission bill doesn't have. And I think that the Human Rights Commission bill hopefully will come, but it will not be as controversial as the legal practice bill.
And the controversial
amount of time. It's a standard for the amount of time we need to spend on a bill. I mean, the superior courts in the Constitution and 17th Amendment were very controversial. We took our time, and we produced a good result. One would imagine that the Human Rights Commission legislation should be able to be disposed of relatively speedily, whereas legal practice, we'll need time to have hearings, we'll need time to engage, we'll need time to think about things. And I think the problem is because that we put a hold on the process, we need to tell everybody, all the interest groups now, that we're starting it again next year. And can I just again stress from this, my honourable colleague, Smut, next year, not this year. I'm not saying we can do anything this year with it. Next year.
May we copy this to you?
I wanted to say this to you. Maybe the other entities I spoke about have a bit of PR. This is not meant as a criticism of the organization. Your focus is on human rights and not on PR. But maybe this is where they trump you. They appear on television, on radio, and in the newspapers, and everyone sees them. And the perception in people's minds is they deliver it. You're not. We don't see you. Here's an opportunity now. I don't see why not. Find a way of taking that particular issue and putting it out there. The A status. And the presidency of, yes, why not? Why not? Find a way of really selling it.
Where is your press liaison officer?
They don't have money to appoint one.
We have recently appointed a head of media and communications. I think one of the difficulties is just in terms of how the commission's been envisaging where it needs to place attention. And where we felt we need to place attention is, for example, when the DPME reports it to us, these are the worst areas in the country in terms of sanitation. That is where we felt we needed to go, not to the cities. So our hearings have all been taking place in effectively rural parts of the country. And media and television cameras generally don't seem to be interested in really coming out to those
areas. Unless the grapevines are burning.
I think the issue of how we communicate that, how we change the communication strategy, because I think when it's something that happens in urban centres, that's where media are located in. So we do put our press release about the hearing.
Just have a rethink.
Yeah, so we need to...
Maybe spend some time with some of your sister bodies.
Yes. Oh, they'll give you brilliant ideas. Mm-hmm.
Can I start when the strategy session might happen?
I need to consult with Mr. Romano and...
That's the money
No. It's going to be here in Cape Town.
It's going to be here in Cape Town, not Berlin, or anywhere like Berlin. All right, I'll get money for the advert, don't worry. All right, I don't think we've got anything left. I've said my thank yous to the commission, and so that's it. We're done for the day.
For the year,
okay. Thanks for reminding me.